Okay, so speaking of ratios, there's two categories of ratios. This is slide 7. The so-called phenotypic ratio, the ratio of phenotypes, is the 3-to-1 ratio I was talking about for the F2 generation in a monohybrid cross if things happen in a Mendelian fashion. That's the famous 3-to-1 ratio, which we see here for flower color. But remember, it doesn't matter if it's Mendelian genetics we're talking about, which we are so far, and it's a monohybrid cross, and you go through all for both generations to get to the F2, then the F2 will have a 3-to-1 dominant to recessive phenotypic ratio. And that's because there's three different ways of four possible zygotes, which is what the Punnett square showed you. There's three ways in which you can have a dominant zygote, right, phenotypically, because dominance means you require only one of the dominant alleles to be dominant. There's three ways that's going to happen, as we saw on that. Well, as we see on this slide, too, right? Upper-upper P, upper-lower P, lower-upper P, which is another version of upper-lower P, because it doesn't matter what order you put them in. Those are all three going to result in purpleness. But there's also a ratio called the genotypic ratio, which is not a ratio of phenotypes, of course, but a ratio of genotypes. And for this same monohybrid cross in the F2 generation, you don't have two numbers involved, you have three, because there's three different genotypes, right? There's two possible phenotypes, but there's three possible genotypes. Homozygous dominant, upper-upper P, homozygous recessive, lower-lower P, and then heterozygous, which is upper-lower P. And the famous ratio for genotype for a monohybrid cross is 1-to-2-to-1 for the F2 generation. The reason it's 2 in the middle is because there's two different ways to become heterozygous, right? Because you can get your dominant allele from your mother and your recessive allele from your father, or you can get your dominant allele from your father and your recessive allele from your mother. That's why the two diagonal boxes in the Punnett square from the previous slide were both heterozygous, right? There's one homozygous dominant to two heterozygous to one homozygous recessive for the genotypic ratio. All right. Let's then go to 8. When you have complete dominance of one allele over the other for a given characteristic or for a given gene, in other words, which we've been talking about so far, then there is only one way that an individual can have the recessive phenotype, right? Because complete dominance means even if you have only one dominant allele, then you're going to have the dominant phenotype and not the recessive phenotype. There's only one way to become recessive phenotypically, and that's to be homozygous recessive. Lowercase, lowercase. Everyone agreed on that? Well, when you observe an individual by, for instance, in this example, looking at its flower color, of course that observation directly gives you the phenotype, right? You can tell a white-flowered individual has white flowers just by observing it. So observation directly gives you the phenotype. But in the case of an individual with a recessive phenotype, observation also gives you the genotype without even looking at the DNA, right? You know that that individual must be homozygous recessive because that's the only way that the recessive phenotype results because of dominance. You following me on this? So you not only know the phenotype for a recessive individual, you also know its genotype just by deductive reasoning. But that's not the case when you look at an individual with a dominant phenotype, a purple-flowered individual, for instance. You can tell it's purple-flowered, you can tell the phenotype by observation, but you can't tell the genotype because there are two different ways to become dominant in your phenotype if you're a pea plant flower. right? You can be homozygous dominant or heterozygous. And because of complete dominance of purple over white, the heterozygous individual is fully purple, just as purple as a homozygous dominant individual. You can't tell them apart just by looking at the flower color. In other words, the dominant phenotype, in the case of complete dominance, is ambiguous with respect to genotype. You can't tell it what the genotype is. But it's often the case that knowing that genotype would be beneficial for various reasons. For instance, if you want to use these plants as true breeders, or you want to make sure they're true breeding individuals so that you want to produce a bunch of only purple-flowered individuals of offspring, right? You want to make sure there aren't any white alleles in those individuals, which is what true breeding means. You want to make sure they're homozygous dominant, in other words. Or you might want them to be heterozygous. For whatever reason, though, it could be useful to know the genotype of an individual with the dominant phenotype. And what we see in this slide is a way to figure that out, called a test cross. A test cross is designed to determine the genotype of an individual with the dominant phenotype. Now, since we're observing the dominant phenotype, we know that there's one genotype or the other. There's two possibilities, right? In the case of flower color in peas, the genotype of this dominant individual is either upper P or upper lower P. It's one of those two. So, what you do in a test cross, before, just as a thought experiment, is you devise two separate Punnett squares, one corresponding to each of these two assumptions. You make a Punnett square under the assumption that the real genotype is upper-upper, and you make another separate one under the assumption that it's the other possibility, upper-lower. But you do this by crossing that with an individual of the recessive phenotype. In other words, a homozygous recessive individual, the white-flowered lower-lower P. Okay, so you see how they differ only in the fact that if you assume that it's upper-upper P, there's only one kind of egg to make. If you assume it's upper-lower P, then there are two kinds of eggs to make. The white one's providing the sperm. And notice that the two Punnett squares differ. The left one says that white ones are not going to be possible, white flowers. The other one tells you that white should appear in about half of the offspring and purple in the other half. So really, once you have these Punnett squares defining your predictions, then you just go ahead and do the cross. You actually do the cross of the one you're trying to figure out the genotype of with a recessive individual. And you look at the offspring. Now, if you get any whites, even a single white, then you know this left one is wrong, right? That's going to prove that the real genotype is heterozygous. If you get only purple, it means this one could be right, but it kind of depends on how many offspring there are, right? If it has just one offspring, you might have just gotten lucky. But if you have a lot of offspring and they're all purple, it becomes increasingly more probable that this is the correct one. Any white, though, this can't be, because it's only possible in the other version. So that's a test cross. In 9, we are looking at a cross again, but this is not a test cross. This is very similar to the crosses that we were looking at before the test cross, which I called monohybrid crosses. What is it that is required for a cross to be a monohybrid cross? What are the two things that monohybrid tells you? Well, one what? One butterfly?
Mm-mm.
One homogeneous radially symmetrical palindrome?
I don't know.
Mono means one, yes, but what is it referring to? You were falling asleep at that moment? A single. Does it look like a single?
Yeah.
Only one. That's what the mono refers to. In a mono hybrid cross, you're paying attention to only one characteristic. All the other characteristics you're ignoring. Like how tall the plant is, for instance. How many leaves it has. You just flower color in that example. All right? What does the hybrid part of the word mean? Well, what does hybrid mean just in everyday language? Yes, it's like a combination of two things, right? So for a monohybrid cross, the mono part refers to the fact that you're tracking one characteristic, and for whatever characteristics you're tracking, the hybrid part refers to the fact that one original parent has one of the traits for that characteristic, the other one has the other trait. So a purple-flowered individual crossed with a white-flowered individual for flower color as the characteristic. That's a monohybrid cross. You can do the same thing, largely, while paying attention to two different characteristics, though. And what do you suppose we call such a cross if we do that? A dihybrid cross. Exactly. Still hybrid, meaning the parents are going to differ in their traits, but they're going to differ in their traits for two different characteristics that we're simultaneously paying attention to. And the trait, I mean, two different characteristics. Did I say characteristics or traits? I meant characteristics. Those two characteristics don't have to have anything to do with each other. It's just those are the two characteristics you're choosing to simultaneously study in a dihybrid cross. So this is a dihybrid cross. What are the characteristics?
P shape
and P color. Exactly. Seed, I'll say, because specifically the seed of the pea plant, which are peas, I admit, but I mean not the whole plant, the pea, the seed. Okay, yes. Seed color and seed shape are simultaneously being paid attention to. And notice the hybrid aspect. In one parent, you have yellow for the color, the other green. And in one parent, you have smooth or round, which is what the R stands for its shape or texture, and for the other one, wrinkled. All right? So you still have the situation in which for each individual characteristic, there are two possible traits. But you're simultaneously paying attention to two characteristics. All right, now, notice next to each parent you have genotypes. Four letters. Why are there two Ys and two Rs for each parent? No, the fact that there are two characteristics is why you have a Y and an R involved. My question is, why do you have two Ys and two Rs? That's not actually why you have that, because that's true whether these things ever get involved in reproduction or not. Each parent has two Ys and two Rs for its genotype, whether it's going to be a parent or not. That's not why this parent, which I just told you, doesn't have to produce any offspring. Even if this parent never produces any offspring, it still has a genotype that consists of two Y's and two R's. Why is that? Yes, that's one way of answering it. Another is that this individual plant is diploid.
Yeah.
There are two Y's because it's diploid. That's why there are two alleles for the Y gene, right? There's two Y's, meaning there are two alleles for the Y gene, which is the color gene. And there are two R alleles for the R gene, because the R gene is for the shape. Right? Remember that characteristics correspond to genes. This is a dihybrid cross. You have two characteristics you're paying attention to. So there are two genes involved, Y gene and R gene, color gene and texture gene, or shape gene, whatever you want to call it. But they're diploid individuals, each parent, and therefore they have two of each. Is that all clear? Notice that one of the parents is upper upper Y, upper upper R. That, in other words, is a doubly homozygous dominant individual. Homozygous dominant for color, seed color, and homozygous dominant for seed texture. The reason we use Y is because yellow is dominant over green. The reason we use R is round is dominant over wrinkled. The other one is lower, lower Y, lower, lower R. In other words, it's a doubly homozygous recessive individual. Homozygous recessive for seed color, homozygous recessive for seed texture. Just as you would expect by definition of a dihybrid cross, right? Now, why, and if you look at the gametes that these two parents produce, there's just one gamete listed under each parent. Why is that? Why is upper Y, upper R the only gamete listed for the yellow round parent? Well, this was an essay question, so that single word doesn't get you full credit. That was a good essay answer to a question I didn't ask. Meiosis is how the gametes are produced, which is also not what I asked. But how does meiosis work? Why is there's no zygote yet. This is a parent producing its own gametes. Like I am right now producing gametes, I'm producing sperm, but I'm not fertilizing anyone or anything, right? I'm not being a parent. I'm just producing my gametes by meiosis. Each of these parents, which never meet, by the way, right? They're individually producing gametes. Why is there only one gamete, though, for each parent?
Possibilities?
Yes, those, well.
So then it just ended up just being YR is one of the possibilities in a random
meiosis? Meiosis randomly chooses one Y and one R. So it doesn't matter which capital Y you choose, it's going to be capital Y, right? That's the point. These are true breeding parents, they're homozygous. So it doesn't matter which of the two alleles you pick, they're identical within that parent. So you choose one of the two capital Y's, you choose one of the two capital R's, that's the only possible kind of gamete that this particular parent can make when all you care about are seed color and seed texture. The only possibility in this other one is to choose a lowercase y and a lowercase r. That's why there's one gamete for each. You see that? And they're haploid genotypes, right? There's only one y and only one r because that's what meiosis does. It reduces the ploidy. The parental genotypes are diploid. The gametic genotypes are haploid, as they should be, because when gametes combine, that's going to get it back to diploidy in fertilization. All right, so that's what this upper Y, upper R, crossed with lower Y, lower R gametes represents. And since there's only one possible egg and one possible sperm, that means there's only one possible type of offspring, right? Upper, lower Y, upper, lower R. A double heterozygote. Heterozygous with respect to seed color, heterozygous with respect to seed texture. That's the only possibility. Therefore, however many individuals there are in the F1 generation, every one of them will have the same genotype. That's the only possibility genetically. Is this clear? Since there's only one possible type of gamete each parent can make, these are the only possibilities, that means getting them together in fertilization results in only one possible type of zygote. If you want me to do it as a Punnett square, I will. It's just a trivial Punnett square. One parent can make this kind of gamete. The other one can make this kind of gamete. So the Punnett square has one box in it. And the only possible way to get those Y's together and R's together is like that. When there's only one possibility, we don't bother drawing the Punnett squares. That's the point here. Does that make it more clear, though?
Yeah.
Okay, good. This means 100% of the offspring, since it's the only possible box here, 100% of the zygotes produced in this cross should be heterozygous, heterozygous. And that's exactly what happens when you do this cross and then look at the peas. They're all going to be dominant color, which is yellow, and dominant texture, which is round. Just like when you paid attention to only one characteristic, all of the F1s were purple, the dominant color. It's just two different characteristics at the same time you're paying attention to here. All right? Then, just like before, you can cross F1 with F1. In other words, upper, lower, Y, upper, lower, R, crossed with upper, lower, Y, upper, lower, R. That's to produce the F2. Each one of these parents is now going to make gametes, right? And meiosis now is going to randomly choose a Y and an R, but now it does make a difference as to which one gets randomly chosen. So these parents can make different kinds of gametes depending on which allele for Y is chosen, which allele for R is chosen. That's all review, hopefully. But what's new here is that there are two Punnett squares shown here. And that's not because it's a test cross, but it is a test of sorts. These two different Punnett squares that are drawn correspond to two different hypotheses, as you see here, one of which is the hypothesis of dependent assortment, the other one of independent assortment. Now, I've already told you which of these is true. I've told you that the truth is independent assortment, right? But first of all, what is that? What is independent assortment? Which hopefully also is a review, because we've covered this. And if you can't tell me what independent assortment is, then at least tell me what assortment is. That's not going to help you fill in A, B, C, or D on a test. Well, to prevent a very long pause in the recording, I guess we'll have to.
I put how one tetrad lines up and is not dependent on that another tetrad. And they all line up different or the same as independently.
That's right. Assortment itself refers to how a tetrad, which is a pair of homologous but not identical chromosomes, line up. And there's two ways, right? Red up, blue down, blue up, red down. That is assortment. Independent assortment means how one tetrad is doing that does not at all depend on how the other tetrads are doing it. They're each individually, randomly red up or blue up. Each one is its own flip of the coin, basically. So, if we did have dependent assortment, that would mean they would line up either all red up and all blue down, or all blue up and all red down. And if that were true, then the color aspect would be tied to the texture aspect. And you would get this Punnett square on the left, which shows as possible zygotes only ones that are like one parent or the other. Right? These three are just like one parent, this one is like the other parent. We call those parental types because they're exactly like one parent or the other. But independent assortment, in which the color aspect is not tied to the texture aspect, means that you should be able to get all possible combinations of these four traits, two color traits and two texture traits. In other words, you should get some parentals, but you should also get some things that aren't like either parent. Offspring that aren't like either parent. And we call offspring that aren't like either parent recombinant individuals. So in this case, the recombinants are the ones that are either yellow and wrinkled, because neither parent is yellow and wrinkled, or green and smooth, green and round, because neither parent is green and round. Well, I've already told you that independent assortment is the truth, but if you didn't know that already, you could do these two Punnett squares to make those predictions, go through with the cross, and see which one is true. The fact that there are recombinant individuals that are produced when you do a real dihybrid cross means that assortment is independent, not dependent. And when is this assortment happening? Yes, more specifically.
Metaphase 1.
Right, metaphase 1. That's the only time tetrads line up at metaphase, right? In metaphase 2, you don't have tetrads anymore. The homologs are in totally different cells at that point. All right, any questions on this? Does this actually make sense?
Yes.
So you're not, that's not a yes just to get me to go on? Okay. Let's go to 10 then. Well, I've used the coin flip analogy before, and that's what this is all about. It's a good analogy because I used the analogy for different processes. Here, the process is random fertilization. Remember, that's one of the three ways in which sex drastically increases the genetic diversity. Right? Do you remember all three of those in order?
Crossing over.
Independent assortment. And random fertilization. Random fertilization refers to randomly choosing one of the gametes produced by one parent and randomly choosing a gamete from the other parent and getting them together, right? So the randomness aspect is what the coin flip is all about. Well, even though it's random fertilization for that dihybrid cross's original parents, they're really, it's the outcome isn't random, right? Because it doesn't matter. When you can only make one kind of gamete, it doesn't matter which one you pick. But here you have a upper lower R crossed with upper lower R. In other words, a heterozygous parent crossed with another heterozygous parent. And each of them can make two different gametes, right? Upper R or lower R. So random fertilization means choose one of the R's from the one parent and choose one of the R's from the other parent. And since there are two possibilities for each parent, that's why it's like a coin flip. It's equally probable to get either one of those. So the individual probability for each gamete of choosing it is one half, either this egg or this egg. Similarly for the sperm. Well, the overall probability of producing a specific zygote like this one in the upper left of the Punnett square is the mathematical product of the probability of getting that particular egg times the probability of getting that particular sperm. So it's one half times one half, which is one quarter. And they all have a one quarter probability. They're all equally probable. And notice that when you add up all these zygote probabilities, it adds up to one, which it has to. One is the total. Something has to happen. Okay. We have finished the Mendelian part of the chapter. Let's quickly, though, review what it means for genetics to work in a Mendelian fashion. In other words, for there to be Mendelian genetics. There are two things that have to be true. What are those? And up to now, they've been true for everything we've talked about. What's the first assumption of Mendelian genetics? What do you mean by types? Use the right term. Otherwise, it's a flawless definition. Yes. Well, you can say it in two ways because there's a correspondence. For Mendelian genetics, for any given characteristic that you're studying, there are exactly two traits. But you could restate that as for any gene that you're studying, because genes correspond to characteristics. For any gene, there are exactly two alleles possible in the population. Alleles correspond to traits. Genes correspond to characteristics. That's one assumption. What's the other? Right. One of those two traits or alleles is completely dominant over the other. And by completely dominant, I mean what we've already been talking about. If you have only one of those dominant alleles, you are still fully dominant in your phenotype, just as purple as the homozygous dominant individual is. That's complete dominance, which is Mendelian, named obviously in Mendel's honor. That's the way certain things work, but it's not the only way things work. In reality, there doesn't have to just be two alleles, right? And there doesn't have to be complete dominance either. So there are a whole set of so-called exceptions to Mendelian genetics, which you could just call non-Mendelian genetics. All right? Which would have been very confusing to deal with for Mendel, who had no knowledge of DNA or or genes. You know, if he would just had to figure things out, if he had picked characteristics in which there were more than two alleles or traits, it would have been confusing as hell, even for how careful he was. But anyway, we're going to go through several different exceptions to Mendelian genetics, using one slide at a time. This first one on slide 11 uses flower color again, but in a different species. That's the characteristic. But this is an exception because it is what's called incomplete dominance. The name itself tells you it's an exception, right? Because one of the assumptions is complete dominance. Well, this is incomplete dominance. Incomplete dominance is still dominance. So, and there are still, in this case, two alleles. Notice there's three colors of flowers, but there's only two alleles, red and white. And red is still dominant over white. So there is still a dominance. But it's not complete dominance because to be fully red, it takes two dominant alleles. If you're a heterozygous plant, you have only one red allele and one white allele, then it makes you only partially red. Half as red as a fully red individual, and therefore pink. All right? So one characteristic, two alleles still, which is an exception, three traits, though, because of incomplete dominance. Twelve uses human blood types as an example. Actually, two examples. There's two separate exceptions here that I'll explain separately. One of those exceptions is called multiple alleles. But don't confuse multiple meaning more than one, which it really does in everyday language. Multiple alleles means more than two, because that's the exception, right? The Mendelian assumption is exactly two. If you have more than two, then that's called multiple alleles. That's non-Mendelian. And what we see here is that there are three different alleles in the human population for this ABO blood group. Let me just give you a little bit of quick background to understand how this blood type works. There are many tens of different human blood groups, and almost no one knows any of them except for two. The two that are famous got famous because they're clinically significant, since they can kill you if you're not careful when you transfuse. And those two, which don't have anything to do with each other, are the ABO blood group, which we're looking at here, and the RH group. So if you have an overall designation of a blood type as something like AB positive, that really is just shorthand for the results of two different tests. Your AB in the ABO group and your positive in the RH group. They have nothing to do with each other. So we're ignoring RH here. We're just concerned with ABO. But this deals with two different kinds of particles called antigens and antibodies. Antibodies are proteins produced in your body to recognize and protect you from antigens. Antigens are particles of foreigners, which is exactly how vaccines work, right? You get a vaccination, and that spurs your body into producing antibodies that will protect you from antigens that can cause things like COVID. Well, here, the antibodies are in part of the whole blood, the liquid part, called the plasma. The rest of the whole blood is the cells themselves, the blood cells. And that's where antigens are, on the surface of the red blood cells. But there's three possible antigen alleles. A, B, and O. Now, they all have I with it. Either with a subscript or not. The I stands for immunoglobulin, which is another name for an antibody, but that's not really important here. I just wanted to tell you that's why it's I. But really, the alleles are A, B, and O, which is why it's the ABO blood group. And the O really isn't an O, it's a zero, because there's nothing there instead. But we call it O. Anyway, you know that that's an exception to Mendelian right there, right? Because you have more than two alleles. But what it means is that if you are type A, then there are A antigens that get put onto the surface of your red blood cells, represented by these triangles. Now, those are not foreign to you, of course. Those are your own blood. Therefore, in the plasma, the liquid part of that same person's blood, there will be no anti-A antibodies. Otherwise, there would be an autoimmune reaction, right? You would reject your own blood. Instead, a person with A, type A blood has A antigens on the cells and anti-B antibodies in the plasma that will recognize type B blood as foreign. And exactly the converse of that for a type B. They produce B antigens on the cells and anti-A antibodies in the plasma. There is dominance here of A over O. There is dominance of B over O, which is why there's two different ways you can be type A, because you're a diploid, right? You have two blood type antigens here. But remember, there's three to pick from. So you could have both of them be A. That, of course, is going to make you a type A. Or you could have an A and an O. Because of the dominance, that makes you type A also. Similarly, two Bs makes you a B. A B and an O makes you B because of dominance of B over O. This brings up the second way in which this is an exception to Mendelian genetics, separate from multiple alleles, and that separate exception is called codominance. Co means share, remember? And the reason this is called codominance is because A is not dominant over B, and B is not dominant over A. In codominance, two different alleles corresponding to two different traits are fully expressed phenotypically at the same time. And so if you are a person that gets an A allele and a B allele, because of codominance, you are type AB. And what I mean by the both traits being fully expressed is that, well, in this case, you're making both kinds of antigens on your cells, right? A and B antigens, and therefore your plasma doesn't have either kind of antibody, otherwise it would reject. But the point here is that a type AB person is just as much type A as a fully type A person, and at the same time is just as much type B as a fully type B person. So both traits are fully expressed in codominance. Since O is recessive to both of those, the only way to become O is if both of your alleles are type O. Right? In other words, homozygous recessive. And in that case, you don't produce either kind of antigen on the cells, but you produce both kinds of antibodies in the plasma to recognize either of the any of the other three as foreign blood.
Is a hybrid of A and B?
Well, OAB, it doesn't exist. You have, you're a diploid. You have two total alleles. There's three in the population possible. So AB already accounts for both of your alleles. You can be AO, that's what this is. I by itself is really O. So AO, because of dominance of A over O, makes you A. It just makes you a heterozygous A versus homozygous A. And similarly for BO, which makes you B.
Okay.
AB doesn't have any O's. It just has an A and a B. And then the real type O people, the only way they can do that is have OO. Well, those are kind of tricky phrases because they refer only to cells or only to plasma. For instance, type O person would never want to give its blood, whole blood, to anything other than another type O person. Right? But whole blood isn't what the only thing you can donate. When you donate blood, you can spin it down in a centrifuge so that you can separately have the cells and the plasma. Now, type O cells, just by themselves, can be given to anyone because it doesn't matter what antibodies they have. There's no antigens for them to recognize. Right? But if you give the plasma of type O person, or the whole blood, which includes the plasma, to any of these others, that blood is going to get attacked by the anti-A and anti-B antibodies that are in the type O plasma. So universal recipient and universal donor, we say this all the time, but it really you need to specify universal recipient of red blood cells or plasma, and universal donor of red blood cells or plasma, not the whole blood. The only way it's safe for whole blood is if you go from one type to exactly the same type. All right, let's go to 13. Look at another exception. This exception is called epistasis. Epistasis is a kind of gene interaction. And specifically what it means is that one gene affects the expression of another gene. And what we're talking about here are protein coding genes, right, which are most genes are. So when one gene gets expressed, that means it goes through the process of transcription and then translation, and some protein is produced, right? Whatever the protein product is of that first gene then determines whether or not a second gene gets expressed, turns on or off. That's epistasis. So the example here are these rats. What is the characteristic? Right, coat color. So there's one characteristic, notice. Look at the genotypes, though, of the parents. Two B's and two C's. Why are there B's and C's if we're talking about one characteristic? No, that's not actually true. It's because of what I just told you epistasis is. The situation in which one gene controls whether or not a second gene gets turned on. So there is the B gene, which is the gene that determines the color of the pigment that is produced. Unfortunately, they both start with B. Black and brown are the two possible pigment colors. But the uppercase B stands for black because black is dominant over brown. Lowercase B means brown. All right? Those are the only, there's only two pigment colors, black and brown. But the C gene, so-called coloration gene, is the gene whose product is not whose protein product is not a pigment. It's a protein that interacts with gene B to determine whether it gets turned on or not. All right? So for gene B to be turned on, you have to have at least one uppercase C allele. If you don't, in other words, if you are doubly, I mean, if you are homozygous recessive for the C gene, two lowercase c's, then the B gene does not get turned on at all. The B one is the one responsible for making the either black or brown, but if it doesn't get turned on, no pigment is made. And that results in white hair. So there's not three different pigments here. There's black and brown or nothing. And the nothing results when the C gene doesn't tell the B gene to turn on. So that means the only possible way to have white hair is if there are two lowercase c's. And you see all four of these possibilities have lowercase c, lowercase c. And in that case, it doesn't at all matter what the B's are, because that gene is not going to get turned on and there's no pigment being produced. Okay? If there's at least one C because of dominance, one uppercase C because of dominance, then the B gene will get turned on and you look at those B's to determine what the color is going to be. All of these ones that are black or brown have at least one uppercase C to turn the B gene on. Then you look at the B's, and as long as there's at least one uppercase B, that's going to be black because of dominance of black over brown. Do you follow all that? Okay, that's epistasis. I'm not going to change the slide yet because this next example I don't have a picture for. So it's kind of like 13 and a half. The next exception, though, is called pleiotropy. And this is the situation in which one gene affects multiple different characteristics. Now notice that up to now, what we've been thinking about is one gene controlling one characteristic, like flower color, for instance. But in pleiotropy, you have one gene simultaneously determining two different characteristics. A good example of this is something we talked a little bit about before, which is sickle cell disease in humans. And the reason I used it as an example before was as an example of mutation, how important mutation is, and how drastically it can affect the function of the protein, right? If just one amino acid is wrong. That can lead to sickle cell disease, which is bad thing to have happen. Early death. But the only way a human can actually have sickle cell disease, since a human is diploid, is for both of the hemoglobin alleles to be the mutant version. To be homozygous recessive, in other words. The dominant one is the normal hemoglobin allele. Now, of course, if you are homozygous dominant, you are totally normal. You don't carry anything having anything to do with sickle cell disease. But it's possible to be heterozygous, right? And because of the dominance of the normal over the sickle cell mutant, being heterozygous means that that one normal allele you have makes you have enough normal hemoglobin for you not to have sickle cell disease. Okay, so you don't have sickle cell disease if you're a heterozygous. But in fact, you're actually even better off than a fully normal person. And that's because being a heterozygous individual also gives you increased resistance to malaria, which kills millions of people a year. And so in a place where malaria is spread easily by mosquitoes, it's actually advantageous to be heterozygous, even better than fully normal. That's why natural selection hasn't just eliminated this defective gene, this defective mutant allele. It's only defective from the viewpoint of hemoglobin carrying oxygen, but from the viewpoint of protecting you from malaria, it's an improvement, and therefore heterozygous individuals are favored, and they have that mutant to pass on to the next generation, and it sticks around in the population. But anyway, it's the reason this is pleiotropy is because that one gene affects not only the hemoglobin shape characteristic, but also the characteristic of resistance to malaria. Okay? Now we can go to 14. And the exception in this case is called polygenic inheritance. Now, what does polygenic tell you?
Five.
Poly means many, and you were right about genes. Right. Multiple genes is what polygenic means. And so what we have in polygenic inheritance is a situation in which multiple genes control one characteristic. Human skin color is used as the example here. So unlike flower color, in which there were the only possibilities were purple and white, there aren't just two skin colors in humans, right? And there aren't even either of the two that we usually use words for. There's no such thing as a white person. There's no such thing as a black person. Every human is some shade of reddish brown. The reddishness comes from the blood that's coming through the skin, and the brownness depends on how much melanin, the pigment, is deposited in the skin cells. So there are extremes, very dark and very light, and everything in between as a continuum of human skin color. Well, if it were just one gene controlling this, then there would be one category or the other. Very light or very dark. But the reason that there can be so many gradations between the extremes is that multiple different genes are contributing to the overall darkness. So each box here represents an individual. The shading represents how light or dark. But the circles in here represent different genes contributing. And the white circle means that that allele is not contributing darkness. The black allele means it is contributing darkness. And so it goes from fully light to fully dark, depending on how many overall alleles are contributing to the overall color. That's polygenic inheritance. Now, compare pleiotropy with polygenic inheritance. They're not technically opposites of each other, but in a sense they are. Because in pleiotropy, you have one gene affecting multiple characteristics, and in polygenic inheritance, you have multiple genes affecting one characteristic. Brings us to 15. These are two plants, the same species. You can see that their flowers have pretty much identical shapes, but they are different colors, obviously. And so that's nothing new. We've been looking at plants that have different color flowers for all this chapter. But you might think that one of them's blue and one of them's pink because they differ in their alleles. In other words, they're genetically different, and that's what causes the difference in the flower. Well, that does cause flower color differences in certain cases, like peas, as we've talked about. But in this case, that's not why these are different colors. These actually are genetically identical plants. No difference in their alleles at all. But one of them is pink and one of them is purple. how can this happen? How can genetically identical individuals differ in their phenotype? How can that happen? Well, that's a good guess, but if a mutation occurs, then they're no longer genetically identical. And so these are genetically identical, and therefore mutation has not occurred. Well, the fact that they're genetically identical means the answer is going to be nothing about genes because there is no difference in their genes. So what besides the genetic makeup of an individual can affect that individual's traits? Still a DNA answer. If you smoke for 40 years and get lung cancer, is that because of your genes? What is it? Well, actually, it does cause mutation, so it does involve your genes. But the reason I use that as an example is because there are environmental components to an individual's phenotypes. And this is summed up in the phrase nature versus nurture. Have you heard this phrase? The nature part of that refers to the DNA that you're stuck with. And the nurture refers to how you're brought up. In other words, what environment you're in. So this could actually be the same individual at different times. If you change the pH of the soil, for instance, it might change the color of the flowers. And for a human example, if you have identical twins, which is a genetic accident, right? It was supposed to originally just be one zygote. It just becomes two. Anyway, they're genetically identical at birth. If you separate them and they lead separate lives in different parts of the world for 80 years, they're not going to be identical still, right? And that's because of potentially drastically different environments that they've been living in. So yes, there's an important genetic component to phenotype, but there's equally important environmental component. Now in 16, I'm not going to exhaustively cover this, but we see some family trees for humans, and these family trees, genetically speaking, are called pedigrees. And if you use these pedigrees and analyze them to figure things out about humans, that's called pedigree analysis. The reason it's important is because we can't use humans for ethical reasons. We can't do experiments on humans to figure out genetic things. Like the test cross I was talking about on the purple-flowered individual, you can't say, okay, let's cross her with this recessive male and see what her kids look like to figure out whether she is heterozygous. Not a lot. Well, first of all, even if you were allowed to do that, it would take a long time with humans. They take a while to spit out the kids. But anyway, can't do it for ethical reasons. Now, nowadays it's pretty easy to just sample the DNA. But before that was possible, pedigree analysis was much more important than it is now. And it really just boils down to figuring out the genotypes of individuals based on looking at their parents or more distant ancestors, right? For instance, if an individual has a recessive trait, but both of the parents are dominant, then just the existence of that child with the recessive trait tells you that one of those two parents at least has to be heterozygous, because one of those parents had to Oh, no, it tells you that both of the parents had to be heterozygous, right? Because the only way for the child to be recessive is to receive two recessive alleles. Since both of the parents are dominant, that means they have to have one dominant and one recessive allele. And things like that. You do that by analyzing the ancestors to figure out truths about the current people. Okay, 17. Here we have two different tests that can be performed prenatally to extract DNA for the purpose of conducting DNA tests to look for genetic defects or whatever. For whatever reason, you can form a karyotype with the resulting DNA. And the difference between these two tests shown here is basically when they're done and what is sampled. Amniocentesis on the left is actually later in the pregnancy. A pregnancy starts out as a zygote, right? That's the single cell, then proceeds to a multicellular embryo, which eventually becomes more developed into the fetus. And so this is in the fetal stage. And the fetus is in the uterus surrounded by what's called amniotic fluid. And that amniotic fluid, since it's in contact with the fetal skin, is, you know, the fetal skin is going to slough off millions of cells into that fluid. So if you just sample that fluid, not even touch the fetus, then you'll get some of the fetal DNA. And as we've learned in lab, a small sample can be amplified as many times as you want with PCR. Well, on the right, you have chorionic villus sampling, which is done earlier. This is labeled as a fetus, but it could be a late embryo based on how it looks. Anyway, when there's a large placenta at this stage, which is half of the property of the mother and half of the property of the fetus, it's where the two bodies come together, there are little finger-like projections on the placenta called chorionic villi, and those just get sucked by a tube to sample that tissue. Once again, not interfering with the embryo or the fetus itself, but getting DNA of that fetus. That is really the end of what I want to say, because 18 and 19 are two parts of one table, but this is a summary table like we've seen in other chapters, so I'm not going to read it to you. The first row, though, is the Mendelian case, and then all the other rows are these various exceptions to Mendelian genetics that I went over today. So it's a good thing to look at as you study, but that means we're done. And I might have time, but I'm not going to start the new chapter this week. So extra minutes of weekend.